Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High in studio with you. And in studio we have with us right now, we have Wendy Powell from the K-State Extension Office. We'll have Jesse Gilmore in here in a little bit. Good morning, Wendy. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing pretty good. First, you want to go over just a few things. There's an event coming up. The Animal Health Day will be coming up pretty soon.
Yes, that is going to be Monday night, March 2nd. That takes place at the Civic Center in Independence, Kansas. This is the 34th annual Animal Health Day event. So it's been going on for 33 years, and this will be the 34th one. So that's a pretty longstanding program for the area. At 5 o'clock, we're going to open the doors for the trade show so folks can come in and visit with vendors. We've got a lot of different industry folks, a lot of different local businesses that will be there with their products and services, so that'll be a great networking opportunity for folks. And then at 6:15, we'll be having a sponsored dinner, and that is sponsored by those trade show vendors. So come on out and support them. Dr. Newby is going to be speaking to the group at 6:30, and then we'll have Dr. Mark Hilton from Elanco talking about hay pads and the bonuses that come with limit feeding hay. And that's going to be for all species, not focused just on cattle, but that'll be for all species. And then we'll have some door prize drawings, followed by our final speaker for the night, Scott Clausen from OSU Extension. He's going to give us some market outlooks, again, for all species. And then we'll have a few more door prizes. So it should be a really fun event for a lot of different folks that covers a lot of different topics. But registration is open until Friday. So go ahead and give a call to the Independence Extension Office. That's going to be 620-331-2690. We'll get you signed up. There's also a registration online. So if you find our Facebook ads for that, then you can sign up online and get registered there. And definitely give any of the extension offices a call if you have questions.
Okay, so and yeah, that's coming up Friday. Deadline to register, though, is on Friday, though, correct?
Friday, yes.
Okay, so
registration is Friday, and that's really just for food count, to make for sure that we have enough to feed everyone that's there. It is free for producers to attend.
Okay.
So definitely come on down. It's a really fun networking opportunity and get some professional development as well.
So that's going to be a great event. And again, that is coming up on Monday, registration on Friday. Like she said, it's basically get kind of a head count so they know how much food to have there, because there will be dinner that night as well. So that's Yes. That's a good thing. All right. Well, we were talking before the show, and the main topic you wanted to discuss today was foot rot and lice.
Yes, all confined animal nastiness to deal with, and definitely this
the
weather.
The unfun stuff.
Yes, the unfun, icky, smelly things, occasionally they can be. So I've seen some research that say like 90% of lameness in cattle stems from the foot, and this is pretty important because cattle do have a long way to walk, and that's going to be fairly similar across all species, so that's not going to be just limited to cattle. And so foot rot is caused by a bacterial infection in the foot, and it's found naturally in the stomach of animals, and therefore it's shed in the feces, and so therefore it's going to be in the pastures and in the pens where every animal walks. It's a naturally occurring bacteria that becomes a problem. But it only becomes a problem when there's a break in the skin. So like in cloven-hoofed animals like cattle, sheep, whenever the skin between the toes or something gets broken, like whenever they step on a rock or, frozen mud, we might have some of that. We've got a lot of wet mud right now. But rocky areas, any of that can puncture that soft tissue that's between the toes. And then that bacteria can get in and really set up shop, and really it releases a toxin, killing cells in there, creating inflammation and swelling. And it's pretty painful. So it's definitely something to keep an eye out for.
Is that one of the times that you'll probably see like a cow just like lay down so they won't have to walk on it?
Well, that's a pretty severe case. Oftentimes, whenever it's first starting, you'll just notice a slight limp, and it might look like a misstep. So you might want to keep an eye on that animal for a while and make sure they are walking okay. And if they're not, if they continue to favor that foot, then go ahead and pull them into the pens and take a look around, because it's definitely something you want to stay on top of, mm-hmm. because it does just continue to decrode those cells inside the foot, and it's just a bad deal. It also causes a lot of odor. So if you take a look at it and it's pretty smelly, then you know you got a case on your hands to look at.
Okay.
So environmental conditions that lead to foot rot: wet weather. So anytime there's lots of moisture in the ground, that bacteria just thrives, mm-hmm. and so it's available to animals to get into
We've had quite a bit of that lately, so especially the past couple of days.
Yes, and it looks like it's still going to be that way for a bit. So really be aware of that situation in commonly visited areas for animals. That's going to be at the watering area, in the shade, or in the windbreak area, and also at mineral feeding places. So those are going to be the areas that are really tracked up anytime that they've pretty much removed all the grass from growing in those areas. That's going to be where foot rot becomes a big problem. So you can move those sites, like you can move a mineral feeder, or if you're working with a portable shade or possibly even a portable windbreak, go ahead and move that around a little bit to move the animals away from areas that could have a problem. Be aware of water tank leaks. That's another way in dry weather that can be a problem if it's just not addressed. And then also limit pond access would be another way to address that problem. You can fence off a pond and put a tank on the lower side of the bank to pipe water in. And that creates a lot of different benefits as well, not just for foot rot. Also, making for sure that the proper levels of zinc and iodine are in the animal's diet, that can provide a little bit of immunity and help it reduce the occurrence. There's been mixed reports on the vaccine that's out there available, so I'm not sure of its efficacy there. And it won't eliminate either zinc or iodine in the vaccine. They won't eliminate the problem, because that problem is still going to be naturally occurring.
Right.
As far as a cure goes, definitely work with your veterinarian. There are some injectable antimicrobials that can be helpful to any animals. And there's a new topical flunixin product that will help with pain control. And definitely whenever you see an animal that might be having problems, the earlier you can get to that, the better off it's going to be. Earlier treatment is going to be easier, as well as more inexpensive. And of course, the longer it goes on, the deeper the infection goes.
So like you said, one of the signs you'll see, one is, you know, you'll see the animal limping a little bit. Kind of keep an eye on that animal. And if you noticed, you know, it prolongs, check them. And you said there'll be an odor to it. And it's going to be an odor that, you know, it's not the odor you're used to smelling from being around a lot of cows.
Yes.
It's going to be awful, because, I mean, I know we know rot smells, you know, smells to begin with. So it's going to be a pretty bad odor, is it not?
Yes, it is.
From that foot.
It's pretty offensive. Yes.
So it's like nobody wants to be around that. But like you said, there are different type of things. There's a topical, which, you know, it's probably the easiest way to do it. An injection, well, you got to just make sure you don't stand behind the cow when you give it the injection, because he's not going to be happy at that point.
Proper restraint.
Exactly. So make sure the cow is restrained properly, so not have to worry about that. So again, that is talking about foot rot, and there's also lice to have to is a pretty big issue as well.
Right. Yeah. Lice can be a really big problem December through March. Anytime animals are huddling up together to stay warm, or whenever they are crowded up into smaller areas. So I've seen research that says $125 million a year in the animal industries in losses. And that's going to be performance loss, so weight, breeding, reproduction losses, but also facilities and fences. And you might think, well, why are facilities and fences affected with lice? And really, when an animal gets lice, just like with a person, it's itchy. It kind of tickles, or you kind of just want to dig at it. So animals are going to do the same thing, but instead instead of using their fingers? Well, because they don't have any. They are going to rub on fences and facilities to satisfy those itches.
Kind of scratch, like a bear does when they want to scratch their back. They rub up against a tree.
That's
so
right.
It's basically the same thing. They're using whatever items they can find to kind of rub up against to kind of get that scratch.
Yeah, that's right, including the feed truck.
Yeah, exactly.
So lice are going to be, they affect the skin, of course, and they feed on skin, but also on secretions. So like eye secretions, things like that. And then there's another type of lice called sucking lice, and they bite through the skin to get through to the blood. They are host specific, so cattle lice don't really affect people. Other animals can have lice problems like horses, but they are very host specific, so they usually don't cross hosts. If a producer is wondering about having lice in their herd, if you're seeing that constant rubbing or scratching on fences or barns, then you probably do have a problem. Also, if you're seeing large hairless patches, so you'll see their nice winter coat, but then all of a sudden in one area or another of their body, it seems like shorter hair, or it looks like they've been rubbing possibly on even the hay bale ring, you'll notice some hair loss from that on the top line, but this will be a little bit different. You'll just see it in different areas of the body. So whenever you're seeing that hair loss, go ahead, if you can restrain the animal and you can part the hair, you'll definitely see the lice. They're about the size of a grain of sand, and you can see them and take care of them. There is a concept we call economic threshold when dealing with pests. Whenever you reach a certain level is when you treat. So they commonly use 10 lice per square inch. So if you think of the size of a square inch, and if you're able to part the hair and see the lice, if you see more than 10, that's when you should treat. That's when the cost of the treatment is going to be cost effective with the performance that's been being reduced from the lice infection. So less than 10 might not be economical.
Right.
Now, if it's me, 1 is economic threshold. So yeah, that's going to be...
Because it could get worse really quick.
That's right. So it depends on what species you're working with, and that's something that you need to establish for your operation as well. How do you treat lice? That's a really good...
Yeah, it can be interesting for sure.
Yes. So there are some pour-on formulations and also some injectables. So a lot of those same formulations will treat intestinal nematodes, so internal parasites, but then they also work on blood feeders, so lice and even ticks. So you definitely want to make sure your herd is treated going into winter, because it's going to be a problem as soon as those animals start grouping up to stay warm. But that efficacy of that treatment might have slacked off throughout the winter, so keep an eye on it, especially this time of year. You might have had a reinfection if one animal happened to have gotten missed, or if there was an introduction of new animals or fence line contact with the neighbor's animals, those lice can move back in. A lot of these treatments will affect the adult lice, but not necessarily the larva or the eggs. So you have to treat the different stages of growth there. There is a new product out that works through insect growth regulation, and it works well on adults and eggs and larvae, so there would be no need for retreatment. So work with your vet if you're having a problem with lice, and see if that product would be helpful to you. Excuse me. Lice are killed by contact, so make for sure that you get a full coverage down the top line of the animal, the pole to the tail head, and then basic biosecurity is a good option there for prevention. Treating and segregating new animals, as well as other diseases, but lice can be effective controlled there.
So, like you said, the cows, they all get together. So even if just one, say you have a group of 20, but even if just have one having it, then they all group together, it can quickly spread pretty quickly, because they can jump to the next animal, and it can spread like pretty much like wildfire.
That's
can it
right.
not?
Yes.
So you definitely want to if you see a cow doing the old let's just scratch in the post over and over, you may want to check that dude out. And like you said, you could see patches of hair missing, and probably just inspect that area. And if you see, like you said, you know, some thresholds are 10 per square inch, but like you said, one is enough for you.
That's right.
That way it doesn't get out of control. So it's like you can get it under control pretty quickly. Well, Wendy, we're going to go ahead and take a break. As Jesse has now arrived. He got tied up a little bit of traffic this morning, but he is going to be in here after the break. So we're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we will have more Green Side Up. Okay. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. And joining us in studio for Green Side Up now is Jesse Gilmore. What is up, Jesse? Good to see you here this morning.
It's good to be here.
Jesse, earlier we had Wendy on, and Wendy's back in studio as well. Wendy, how you doing?
I'm great. How about you?
Doing good. Earlier she talked about industrial hemp and she did not talk about that. She talked about foot rot and lice. You're wanting to discuss industrial hemp and also gardening and wet soil.
Yep. Gardening and wet soil seems to be a very timely topic, especially with the recent rain and the record-setting rainfall for last year. Knowing what kind of plants tolerate wetter soils is very important in order to ensure that your garden plants stay alive through the wet part of the year, which is coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, and it's even just the past 2 days, it's been pretty wet out there. And like you said, the historical rainfall we had last year. So what are some of the tips about gardening in wet soil and that we could use out there?
Well, in general, the best way to garden in wet soil is to make sure that you have the right plants in the right place. Knowing what kind of site you're trying to plant in is very important for selecting the right plants. So in weather such as the weather we've had earlier this week, it's a good idea to go out and look at your site that you want to plant in and see if there are drainage issues. You would look at potential standing water in the site and note low spots in the landscape that you want to plant in, and select plants that are more tolerant of wet soils and particularly clay soils. So if you've taken a soil sample by now, which it is the time of the year to take soil samples and bring them in if you haven't already, if you're curious about the nutrients in the soil, you should also have seen the texture of the places where you took the samples. In heavier soils with a lot of clay, they're going to hold water a lot more because the clay particles are smaller and can be packed closer together. In landscapes, not so much in landscapes, but in field conditions, this can be a bit of a problem because there's what's known as the clay pan, mm-hmm. where water has a very hard time infiltrating and basically percolating through the soil. If your clay pan is very high in the soil profile, you're going to have a lot more problems with drainage. And it's kind of a lose-lose when that happens, because if you till in order to try and break up the clay pan, you run the risk of erosion in wetter seasons. And you can also break weed seed dormancy if you manage to hit a seed bank area. But if you don't till, then you have the drainage issues. So knowing what plants work in those parts of the landscape is very important.
Yeah, so it's difficult to kind of figure out which one to do because, you know, there's cons on both of them, but is it not almost sometimes a guessing game with that, just to try to, to figure out which one to do, whether to till or not?
Yeah, it is. When it comes to homeowners, most of the time you won't have the technology or the machinery needed to till, unless you have a personal rototiller that can get into garden beds and you know exactly where your utilities are. Don't dig without marking those out. The one strategy that I think homeowners have a real control over when it comes to improving the soil texture in order to improve drainage is ensuring that there's a stable population of earthworms in your soil. They'll dig through your soil, turn it over, and basically form tunnels for water to infiltrate through the soil profile. You want to make sure that there's a lot of organic matter in your garden beds for the worms to attract the worms to your garden soils. Compost is particularly helpful, but any kind of like leaf litter, grass clipping, stuff like that.
So earthworms, they're kind of your friend there. They're kind of helping you out there a little bit, making, like you said, making those little tunnels. That way the water can kind of get in there, and that helps whatever you're growing kind of absorb that water, does it not?
Mm-hmm. As far as plant selections go for wet soils, common names can be particularly helpful when it comes to selecting wet-tolerant species. There's a species of oak called swamp white oak, which, you know, is pretty fitting for southeastern Kansas. You also have bald cypress, which is a very moist, soil-loving tree. And then you look at a lot of native species for perennials. There's swamp milkweed, a lot of swamp. If it's got swamp in the name, you can pretty much assume it's going to do well in wet soil.
Yeah, since swamp is kind of very wet, so yeah, it's probably going to do pretty good with a lot of wet soil.
Yeah, but you also have to make sure that it is adapted to our region. You can assume that most native plants will do well in our region. So if you know native plants, it's a matter of looking up whether or not they tolerate wet soils at that point.
So basically, familiarity is a good thing. Stuff that is native to our area. Those are just a few tips there for gardening and wet soil. And you also wanted to talk about industrial hemp today, because hemp is one of those things that is starting to kind of get big in this part of the United States.
Yep, and there's a lot of things that people need to know if they want to get into hemp production. David and I had the opportunity to attend the Kansas Industrial Hemp Conference in Wichita, I think 3 weeks ago now, and we learned so much about hemp. So hemp is the cultivated form, well, I guess it's not just the only cultivated form, but it is the non-psychoactive form of cannabis sativa, or the marijuana plant.
Mm-hmm.
It is marijuana that is grown with lower than 0.03% THC by dry weight. So that is a very low percentage of tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, the psychoactive substance in marijuana,
right,
to the point where it's not effective as a psychoactive drug. People aren't going to smoke hemp because it's so low in the psychoactive substance that it's not worth smoking. Hemp has a lot of potential as both an agronomic crop and as a horticultural crop. I think when David next comes on the radio, she's going to talk about its agronomic benefits.
Okay.
I'm going to focus mostly on the horticultural side of it, which is specifically for cannabidiol oil, or CBD. Thank goodness they shortened these oil names, because pronouncing them is a pretty tricky.
And CBD, I've actually used some CBD oil for like stuff with my knee, and again, like you said, that's non-psychoactive, so that's, you know, that you're not going to be getting, you know, you're not getting any kind of high off of that, like you said, because it's such a small amount of THC, it's not even like that. But I've used CBD oil before, and it is very good, though. It does help.
Yep. Lots of medical research is going into the effects of CBD oil right now, and there was kind of a rush to produce CBD oil for most of the hemp growers in Kansas. There are two things you need to be very careful of when producing hemp. The first, if you're producing it for CBD oil, there cannot be any pollination between plants. Doing that will almost ensure that your plants are going to go hot and have more THC than the legal allowable limit. So if you have plants that are below 0.03% THC, that is legal. You are in compliance with the state standard for THC content. If you're between 0.03% and 0.05%, you're in what's called a non-negligent compliance violation, which means that you did not intentionally grow hemp with greater than the legal allowable limit of THC, your crop would have to be destroyed at that point, but you're not liable for prosecution, for criminal prosecution.
Right, because it's not like you did it on purpose. It just, it happens sometimes, you know.
Yep. But if you have hemp that has greater than 0.05% THC by weight, then you're in what's known as a negligent compliance violation, and you are liable for criminal prosecution at that point. So you need to make absolutely sure that your hemp does not go hot. And in the production of CBD, that would mean roguing out or removing every male plant in your growing area. And there are people who have put hundreds of acres into hemp. Now, likely these people are more into fiber and grain, which is the agronomic side of hemp production. Mm-hmm. But if you're growing CBD hemp, you do not want so much acreage that you cannot go out and physically look for the male plants on a weekly or biweekly basis. Because if you let the male plants go and they start pollinating the female plants, then you run the risk of your crop going hot and having to destroy it, and you open yourself up for potential prosecution. So knowing the life cycle of the hemp and what to look for in the difference between male and female plants is incredibly important for CBD production.
Well, for somebody that doesn't know that much about hemp, though, what is the, just by looking at the plants or inspecting them, what is the difference between a male and a female plant?
I don't actually know. They did talk a little bit about that at the conference, and I believe a Davin would know more about that than I would. It has to do with flowering.
Okay.
So there are organs in the flower that are only on male plants, and then there are organs in the flower that are on female plants. And being able to identify that organ on the male plants will tell you which of the plants in your acreage are male.
Right. So you don't want to mix the male with the female, because then, like you said, the pollination will happen, and then the like you say, it gets hot really quick, so to speak, and then the THC level goes up, and then you can get in trouble pretty bad, you know, with being prosecuted for growing, which could be almost considered just straight up marijuana, pretty much, with the high THC. So you got to be watch out for that. But it's kind of a newer thing, though, in Kansas. It's not hemp production.
Yes. So I want to say it was 2018 when they decided to legalize hemp. We've been doing research at the John C. Pear Horticulture Center on hemp production for grain and fiber, and at the Olathe Horticulture Research and Extension Center for CBD production. There is no quota to the number of hemp producers that can have a permit in Kansas. That's a common misconception about hemp that I actually had until I went to the conference. However, for the 2020 growing year, they have already closed down applications for permits. Those typically happen in October to November. So if you are interested in pursuing hemp, you would talk to Braden Hawk at the Kansas Department of Agriculture about potential permitting. The one thing that I will say, however, is that it's very important to know where your market is. For CBD, there's a bigger market than grain or fiber, because there's a more medical producers who can take that. It is actually illegal to transport hemp across state lines, so when you produce anything from hemp, you are limited to the manufacturers or processors within the state of Kansas. And knowing who you're going to market through is very important before getting into hemp production, because if you have a crop and have no one to sell it to, you have basically wasted an entire growing
season. With a crop you can't even sell. So you got to make sure it's for somebody in Kansas, because like you said, it's illegal to transport that across state lines. I know Oklahoma has started doing hemp recently as well. I think it was near the same time that Kansas did. So it's a kind of a newer thing thing in this part of the area, and it's going to be interesting to see how well it takes off, but it sounds like it's doing okay to begin with. You said there was quite a few applications for this year, right? Correct?
Yep. But again, and I really cannot stress this enough, have a good relationship with processors. Two-thirds of the hemp producers in the state of Kansas lost money last year because they had either because their crop went hot and they had to destroy it, or because they didn't have sufficient market channels for their for what they produce.
So get those market channels before you start doing that. That way, you when you set it up and are able to actually able sell it you're ready to sell it. Going to go back over here to Wendy real quick before we get out of here today. And Wendy, just one more time, if you would like, if somebody hadn't been listening earlier, about the Animal Health Day coming up, if somebody was not listening earlier, you can tell them about it.
Yeah, Animal Health Day is coming up on Monday night. It's going to be at the Independence Civic Center, Memorial Hall and Civic Center. That's going to open at 5 p.m. for the trade show, and then we'll have a sponsored dinner followed by a few industry talks that will be very timely and apply to all species. So this is definitely not just a cattle meeting this year. It's the 34th annual Animal Health Day. Get your reservations in by Friday. Call the Independence Extension Office, 620-331-2690. Or look us up on the our Facebook page, and you can follow the link for the online registration. So it's really important to get these RSVPs in so that I have enough food for everyone to enjoy.
That's right.
Looking forward to seeing everyone there.
It's going to be a lot of fun. So, again, you said you can contact you through Facebook. But for any other kind of questions that maybe you've covered today, is there another way to contact you?
My home office is the Altamont office. That's going to be 620-784-5337.
And Jesse, if anybody has like any more questions about hemp or maybe gardening in wet soil, how can they get a hold of you as well?
They can call the Girard office at 620-724-8233, or they can email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. Well, Wendy and Jesse, I appreciate you guys coming on today, giving us a lot of great information, and we appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll have Open Line. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGF.